All right, we are ready to let in your amazing audience. They've been so patient. So let's let them all in. It's always fun to see them pop in. Look at all these lovely faces, names and faces and friends. And I see some people I just saw recently at the on-site conference. We'll talk about that in just one second. There we go. Looks like everybody made it into the doorway, but we'll have some others joining because as soon as I say everybody made it through the doorway, more people will pop on. We know that's the rule, right? Okay. But anyway, before I turn things over to our guest today, because I know that's why you're really here, not to see me. That's okay. I am fine with that because I'm here to hear what they have to say as well. And just like that, see, somebody popped into the waiting room because I knew that would happen. All right. So welcome. You have arrived at the Friday webinar series. Hopefully that was your intended location. If not, you should hang out with us anyway, because this is going to be really awesome and you'll learn some cool stuff. But first, I have to let you know, we will have doctors, Dennis and Golston and Rowe and everybody here today. I love when we have like a group of people. It makes it even more awesome. But I'm going to turn things over to them in just a minute. But first, I want to remind you that we do this almost every Friday. You'll notice we're taking a little tiny break. I'll explain why in a second, but we will have Bernardo Latif here in mid-July, and he's going to be helping you be even more engaging. So that's coming up. You can register for that already. And then in August, we are bringing back something that we did a couple of years ago, and it was very popular. And so we wanted to bring it back. And that is the first Friday of each month, we're going to be featuring our USDLA chapters. So the first three up, we have more scheduled, but I just squeezed three in for today. In August, you'll get to meet and hear more about and hear a speaker from the Delmarva chapter. In September, we'll be visiting Florida. It won't be any cooler there by then, but that's okay. We'll be visiting them virtually, so that's okay. And then in October, we're going to head up to our Ohio chapter. And again, they'll tell you a little bit about their chapter, but they'll also be bringing in a speaker from their area. So those topics and speakers will be announced shortly, but stay tuned for that. Also, want to remind everybody that most of our videos get posted, the replays get posted to our new YouTube channel, usdla.tv. Very easy to find and remember. And I've already talked to people today, and this one will be available to you shortly. So watch the newsletter. We always announce when a new one goes live. But while you're at YouTube, go ahead and subscribe so you don't miss out on anything. And as you see, one of the last ones we had was on AI. I know that's a hot topic. So you probably want to head over there right after the webinar. Don't go now. Right after the webinar, you can head over there and take a look. All right. Do also want to remind you, if you were registered for any of the conference, we have one more virtual day on Tuesday. And if you are currently a member or you join us as a member, you'll have access to all of the archived video content from the conference. We had virtual days. We had content that was recorded on site. So it's a whole host of wonderful content that would be made available to you. So check that out. In coming months, we'll also be bringing in some of the award winners who just received their plaques last week at the conference. We'll be bringing them in to help share more about their stories because they're award winners for a good reason. They have a lot of great innovations. They have some best practices they would share with you. You get to ask them questions about their experience, the whole nine yards. So stay tuned for that as well. Also, save some dates. We have public policy items coming up. One day in September and then a whole week in January. And again, we'll remind you all of this, but it's good to get them on the calendar. And then, as always, National Distance Learning Week is the first week of November. So that is November 4th through the 8th this year. We will have a whole week of free programming for you. So please mark that down. And if you work at an institution that is hosting some content that week, we know many of your associations and institutions and organizations have National Distance Learning Week programming now. We would love to hear about that because we do share links to other events on our website so that people can get the full benefit of all the offerings. And then finally, I have to say a quick Thank you to all of our sponsors. They help keep the lights on here and they help make this content free for you. So thank you. We have our platinum sponsor. It's hard to see on this one, but that's John Chen at Engaging Virtual Meetings. He was our video producer on site. And if you have not seen his work before, you do not want to miss it. I mean, virtual and hybrid production, like you probably have not seen before. I'm just going to leave it right there. So go check that out. Also our gold and silver sponsors. And finally, we never forget our bronze sponsors. Too many of them to name, but if you see people on the list that you're familiar with, reach out to your rep and say hi. If it's somebody you're not familiar with, reach out and find out what they do because it's a whole host of services. Everything, hardware, software, platforms, you name it. There's probably somebody on here that does it, all serving all of distance education just as you are. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing. Enough yak 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 for me. I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Dennis. I believe she's going to start things off for us and introduce her colleagues. And I just want to thank the three of you for being here today. And we turn it over to you now.
Thank you so much, Valerie. We are just delighted to be here. Thanks everyone for attending this Friday webinar and giving us the opportunity to share our pilot with you. I will start out just with some introductions. So I am Michelle Dennis. I work as a curriculum director. I'm serving the College of Business, Engineering, and Technology at National University. And I'm joined by the dean of our college, Dr. Eric Rowe, and one of our academic program directors, Dr. Justin Goldston. He is the program director for our Bachelor of Science in Supply Chain Management and Logistics program. And so I've had the opportunity to collaborate with Dr. Rowe and Dr. Goldston on this pilot. And I will start out then with just some highlights of the research that we'll share with you. Later on in our talk, Dr. Goldston, who is a resident expert here, will talk in more detail about blockchain technology later on, and he's going to be sharing a demo with all of you as well, going over how we use blockchain in our pilot. But just very, very high level, blockchain involves storing records in a permanent ledger so that we can share the records across networks. And so it is a very effective way to document and to share data with others. It preserves it in a way that other technologies really can't securely do. Blockchain has been used in many fields, and in recent years, it's been used in higher education. And so we wanted to use this technology to increase the portability of our micro-credentials, or in other words, to make it easier for students to bring those credentials along with them, right? As if it were a little bag and we could easily put it across our shoulder and bring it with us. We wanted to increase the portability of the credentials. So what we basically did was we created three micro-credentials by disaggregating the content of one graduate level course. We do hope to expand this initiative in a number of ways. We want to ultimately continue to disaggregate the courses in the program that I will share about a little bit later on. The benefits of this is number one, it allows students to complete smaller learning units. So if someone is maybe pressed for cash or pressed for time, they ought to be able to walk in and take something smaller. And they ought to be able to keep that in their back pocket and use it so that they can obtain gainful employment while they are continuing to collect these credentials. They ought to be able to stack the credentials, ultimately increasing their earning power, as they go on throughout programs. And we want to make that easy for them. We want to create more flexibility for our students. This increases equity in a number of ways. And so sort of going forward, that's our ultimate goal. So I want to move into talking briefly about the goals of the pilot. So there were four main goals. First of all, we wanted to create more opportunities for our current students. So National University, where we are at, serves non-traditional students. Our students are working professionals. They have families. Higher education is an important goal for them, but that's not the only thing that they are working on. And so being able to find gainful employment while completing their degrees is a key priority for most of our students at National. So this alignment of our credentials is very key for us. Aligning these micro-credentials with industry certifications is something that we want to do going forward. This is a way to increase employment opportunities for our current students at National. Goal two is about our prospective students. So many students lose out on transfer credit. Why? Because perhaps courses they have taken align with some aspects of a potential transfer course, but not all aspects of that potential course. And so then they don't get credit. They have to take the class again. They have to pay again. They have to be less than optimally engaged for at least a portion of that course because they're repeating content, right? And so to disaggregate the course into its components, micro-credentials helps these students. It gives them an on-ramp. They can come in, they can take the first part of the course, or they can take the middle part of the course, or the last part of the course, or the entire course, because it's all there and it's all been taken apart for them. More transfer credits, less tuition, better student outcomes. So the third goal of the pilot was to, starting with the end in mind, make sure that content and rigor of each individual micro-credential really was aligned with the fact that this is an academic credit-bearing course. And so the resulting micro-credentials also are academic in nature and they bear credits. And so we wanted to make sure that everything was aligned, that students going into the micro-credentials knew what they were signing up for. And so again, the way that we accomplished this was to disaggregate the course into smaller components. The final goal was to increase portability of credentials. And so we wanted to facilitate ease of documentation, ease of sharing, oftentimes people will go online and take a certificate program, and then they lose it. They can't even tell you, because I've seen it on LinkedIn, you know, people talking about, oh, I took XYZ course. Where did you take it? I would love to take that course. I don't know. People don't know what courses they've taken, and if they do, they don't really know what it means or what they have learned. And so we really wanted to make it easier for students to take that along with them. And so hence the use of blockchain technology. So I would like you to either scan or go to slido.com. Take some time to enter this number here. I want you to share your either ideas or personal experience or professional experience with micro-credentials. Have you heard of micro-credentials? Would you be able to define the term? What was the context? Someone's typing. Yay. Have you heard good things about micro-credentials? Have you heard bad things about them? Do you think that they are useful? Do you have one? Do you know anyone that has one? And so while people are continuing to type, I will tell you about my personal professional experience with micro-credentials. So anyone who has applied for a job like in the last 5 years knows that interview processes are quite involved lately, right? Am I right? And usually you go to multiple interviews and sometimes you do fun activities like a presentation. And so my first formal exposure to the concept of micro-credentials was being asked to develop a presentation on micro-credentials for an interview. So I went all out, did lots of research. That's how I learned about micro-credentials. More recently, I earned one in AI, hot field. We are getting lots of participation here. So work, yes. Great experience, spoken, professional, adopted. Know about them, no direct experience. Heard of micro-credentials, but not related to blockchain technology, shareable, industry aligned, stackable. Great. So lots of ideas about micro-credentials, gamification tool. Oh, I love that. Pathways on and off ramps. I completely agree. And so nothing really negative that people have shared, all positive and am coordinating. Oh, okay, awesome. So someone's working with micro-credentials. You should look us up because maybe we can collaborate on this. So great. Well, thank you for taking time to share your experience with micro-credentials. So let's talk a little bit about what micro-credentials are. And just as an aside, we don't really know what micro-credentials are. These are my ideas. This is what a lot of people think micro-credentials are. But people disagree about it, right? We're still establishing micro-credentials. We're very early in the process of defining and regulating and approving micro-credentials. So micro-credentials tend to be small. They tend to be compact. They're very targeted learning experiences. They tend to focus on real world skills. Career relevance is related to micro-credentials. You're likely to find micro-credentials in certain areas like technology and business. You might not find them in others like art appreciation. Or you might. I don't actually know, but I'm presuming that you wouldn't. Like, her credentials tend to, or I believe should, include clear assessments. They're often stackable, as some of you mentioned. It's beneficial that they're stackable because then they provide easy on and off ramps, offering more flexibility for students. Students can start small. Maybe they don't want to make a very big commitment right away, and then they can build up to earning larger credentials or degrees. Micro-credentials are oftentimes very attractive to individuals who want to change their industry without getting another degree, because degrees are expensive. Micro-credentials are very valuable, but there are a lot of challenges associated with them as well. And so that is what we will talk about next. So, number one, as I said, we don't really know what micro-credentials are. So sometimes micro-credentials are smaller than certificates, and sometimes they're not. And what is a certificate anyway? And we have to highlight the difference between a certificate and a certification, and a post-baccalaureate certificate, and a post-master's certificate, and a graduate credential. And so there are all these definitions that make it really challenging to talk about micro-credentials. So in terms of their utility then, in one's career, if I apply for a job and I say I have a micro-credential in AI, I do. What does that mean? Well, for me, it means I went online and I spent about, ooh, 20 hours or so, completing readings and videos, and I took a lot of tests, and now I know a little bit about AI. Okay. But for the micro-credentials that we created here by disaggregating our graduate level course, those students would have a very different experience because these are academic credit-bearing micro-credentials. And so they involve having interactions with faculty, with peers in the course. With content. So very different. All of that to say that, in terms of format and rigor, there's a very big, variation across different micro-credentials. And that makes it very challenging for us to define them and for us to say what they really prepare people to do. The next challenge is with documentation. Many micro-credentials are accompanied by digital badges, like from Credly, for example. And that's helpful because you can read a little bit about what the micro-credential involved when you check the person's badge. So that can be a helpful way of documenting one's micro-credential. Very few micro-credentials are transcripted because most of them don't carry academic credit. And those that do would be transcripted. But there's got to be an easier way. Do you know how challenging it is to request one's transcripts, official transcripts? If you have multiple degrees, it's actually going to cost you too. You have to pay for that. And so there's got to be a better, more efficient way. We wanted to address some of the challenges that are associated with micro-credentials, i.e., problems with a lack of alignment with format, varied rigor, and documentation through our pilot. And so what
So
we did,
before we jump
yeah.
into the pilot, just let me, I want to just build on what you were saying there for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, that credential transparency piece, right, is a real challenge, around understanding what competencies a learner has and how you navigate the complexities of the credential landscape, without consistent tools, consistent information. It is kind of the Wild West right now of micro-credentials, right? Because anybody can create a badge. So, thinking about it as a learner, wanting to have a credential of value, or as an employer, wanting to understand that somebody is earning a credential that has validated competencies, right? Are the challenges. And so, there are some great initiatives out there like Credential Engine working on credential transparency description language and kind of setting some unified standards by which, the skills and knowledge and competencies that are within a credential can be mapped and then move in and out of LMSs and competency management systems also, and employers can see that. But I think the challenge for us in education is, how do we create a micro-credential, a certificate, a graduate certificate, in this case, smaller learning blocks, align those with industry standards like industry certifications. You mentioned the difference between a certificate and a certification. Creating that ability to document what competencies it has and crosswalk those to known credentials of value, like a degree, or a certification. So, this piece we're about to, and so as you were going, like that's what was going through my mind around credential transparency. So for our audience, right, this course disaggregation piece does a couple things for us, right? It lets us look at that credential transparency, linking the competencies that are in the program to, in this case, the blockchain, to an academic course. And ultimately, because in the space we're going to be talking about is logistics and supply chain management, there are industry standards also, right, that we can link with. So we're trying to connect, we're taking that Venn diagram, right? We're trying to work in the middle of that Venn diagram. And then later I'll talk to the team here a little bit about what we have going on in the future, but just some context setting before we move into the pilot.
Yeah, no, super well said, Eric. Dr. Rowe, I completely agree. And so, one of the things related to what you were saying, Dr. Rowe, that's super important is if I can hop down to my fourth bullet point here, removing the transitions between the modules. So that was key in terms of our course disaggregation initiative. What we really wanted to do was create the on and the off ramps for our students. We wanted to make sure that a student could take each micro credential alone and that it would still make sense. So when we started with the end in mind, with the actual course, we actually had, of course, transitions from module to module so that it would make sense for the student to go from module to module. And we had to remove those so that each unit could be offered as a standalone for our students. Something else that was really important for us was the student experience and how you really have to consider student experience in all aspects of higher education, but particularly when you are going to have a short-term experience, like a micro-credential. So making sure that each of the micro-credentials had opportunities for engagement with content, peers, the instructor, to increase the student engagement. And then finally, in terms of increasing granularity for requisite paths, it was important for us to make sure that we define what knowledge was needed to go into each micro-credential, or in other words, each part of the course. And so moving to the course, we selected a course for the pilot, which is the first of three courses in a specialization in financial technology that's offered through an online MBA program. As an aside, these three courses are also offered as a standalone certificate, post-baccalaureate certificate, which then includes a capstone experience. So this first course, Intro to Financial Technology, focuses on a couple of things. It focuses on essentials of financial technology. It focuses on innovations in the financial sector. And then it focuses on relevant business models. So depending on the experience of a student, students completing the whole course might be prepared for entry-level careers in things like compliance specialist or automation engineer or risk management specialist. And this is just me looking at the requisite competencies that are found in the course learning outcomes of the course here, and then comparing them to job descriptions. So we started to disaggregate the course by looking at these course learning outcomes, and they actually divide quite nicely into three parts here. The first two objectives focus on general applications of financial technology. Course learning outcome 3 and 4 seem to center on methods and tools associated with financial technology. And then the final two seem to center on risk management, the idea of risk management. And so the resulting three micro-credentials then, in terms of naming, we really try to exercise transparency. We believe that each of these credentials could be very useful to students as a standalone credential, as well as stacking each credential on the other to build a course, and then continuing to build multiple courses and the entire specialization, three-course specialization, or certificate. And so at this point, I have talked enough. And so I'm going to pass the mic to Dr. Goldston, who is going to talk about blockchain and then how we made these credentials portable.
All right. Thanks for that. So, I mean, if you all have you know, heard of blockchain, you may have had some, a little bit of background, a little bit of introduction to it. A big misconception is that, you know, cryptocurrencies is, you know, the only use case for blockchain. I mean, we've seen the Bitcoin ETF in March, the Ethereum ETF got passed in, I think about a month ago. VanEck just issued an application for a Solana ETF just yesterday or Monday. So this week sometime, you know, so because of this, yes, because of cryptocurrencies, that's kind of the jumping off point to people looking into this technology, right? So I did 5 TED Talks on blockchain in 2019. You can go to TED.com and look at some of those use cases. And the one thing is, a lot of those use cases I said in 2019 got implemented during COVID. because we needed to track and trace a number of things like the vaccines, like counterfeit items and things like that. That's what blockchain is used for. It's used for that transparency. It's used for that tracking and tracing. It's used a lot from within the supply chain industry. It's used a ton within fintech. You know, it's going to disrupt the fintech space. You know, we had a debate yesterday. I didn't watch it, but you know, candidate Trump, he's accepting cryptocurrencies for campaign donations. Biden was against cryptocurrencies, but now he's actually accepting donations. You know, people were saying that the Biden administration was against, you know, blockchain and crypto, but you know, they were trying to put together a task force to essentially combat the nefarious actors. So they were trying to clean up the space, you know. So I sometimes have to kind of correct those statements. You know, he's not against it. He's just trying to correct this, you know, clear the space, which is much needed. But going back to the technology itself, again, I always say that blockchain is nothing but a transparent Excel spreadsheet. That's essentially all it is, right? So if you can think of it that way, I'll put in a transaction on an Excel spreadsheet. Everybody in the world can see that transaction. People within the blockchain get rewarded to validate that particular transaction is indeed correct, and then it gets published on the blockchain. Now, there are public blockchains, there are private blockchains, there's also hybrid blockchains, right? In the case for these micro-credentials, yes, that's going to be a public blockchain. Now, from a university perspective, we could have a hybrid blockchain where student records, as well as like financial aid and things like that, that can be on a blockchain as well, where you could actually have a private key where you could actually go in and actually view that particular information. We're kind of getting deep here, but all these particular use cases are possible. But in the case of this, we can have micro-credentials where, and we're going to go through a demo shortly, but so if we go through this little infographic here, I create a class. Once I complete that class at National University, that's a trigger where that trigger actually goes to the blockchain. And that transaction creates a cryptographic key, a hash, if you will, right? So once that hash gets created, that's a trigger on the blockchain to say, okay, go and see whether or not this credential is indeed accurate. Once that validation is corrected, then that gets written to the blockchain, right? And then that gets broadcasted for everyone to see. So now that's on chain. And as Dr. Dennis was saying, I don't know where it was at. Now you don't even have to worry about what application you took that class in. You only have to worry about what blockchain you put it on, right? And you'll see that all this stuff hopefully will make sense in the next 5 or 10 minutes or so. But once all that information is broadcasted, now that's transparent on blockchain. Always, it's immutable, can't get erased. And because blockchains are decentralized, it's essentially never going to go down. Right? So there's no defunct organizations in terms of blockchains. There's no organizations that even the organization like FTX and Terra Luna. So you might have heard of Terra Luna and the FTX crashes. They were up in Washington D.C. about those. Even those although those companies failed, the blockchains are still operational because the blockchains are decentralized, right? So that's another benefit to this. So there's no credentialing companies that's going to go bankrupt. It's still going to be there. It's still going to be on the blockchain. Okay. If you go to the next slide, hopefully that made sense. I know I threw out a lot of things there. So in terms of recent applications for blockchain, again, fintech is one of the big ones. We in the blockchain space, we say TradFi and DeFi. So TradFi is traditional finance and DeFi is decentralized finance. So within decentralized finance, if you have particular, assets, so you have Bitcoin, you have Ethereum, I could trade from peer to peer. I don't need to do a background check, right? It's actually a trustless environment. So if I don't want to, so if I, let's just say hypothetically, I have $10,000 in Bitcoin. If I don't want to sell, if I don't want to sell my Bitcoin, I can actually collateralize my Bitcoin just like a regular loan in TradFi, and I can get $7,000 in stablecoin, USDC, right? So I'm collateralizing my digital asset, and I'm actually getting fiat if I wanted to. So that's what we talk about when we're discussing DeFi, right? And you're going to see more and more of that with these ETFs coming on the scene. And then let's get, I mean, I'm getting contacted by a number of people in traditional finance to kind of do little quick webinars on things like this. Healthcare, again, tracking all of those documents and things like that. Real estate, there's a lot of organizations in Europe that's actually putting titles on the blockchain. They're actually having these large commercial buildings, and they are separating this, right? They're separating this. So let's just say a building's 1.5 billion, right? So now you're actually having things such as NFTs to actually get a piece of that real estate, and that NFT actually represents a portion of that particular application or that particular physical property. So you're going to see more things such as real world assets. BlackRock's starting to do a lot of things in art, what we RWAs, real world assets. So you're going to start seeing a lot of things in terms of that, in terms of blockchain and real estate. Education, again, credentializing academic records, putting academic records on a blockchain. I think we've all had to order a transcript and pay $30 for I forget the name of it, but parchment. I think it's parchment or something like that, you know, and you have to wait a couple days to get it, and you're calling the school and say, hey, did my things come in? And oh, let me go to the mail room. If we have this on chain, it's immediate. You can just send them a link. It's right there. It's immutable. There's no argument, right? Because it's on chain. So again, data security. Security is a big issue with any area. I would say that we're going to have even more importance of cybersecurity concerns coming up, and a blockchain is one of those things that can actually mitigate that risk in terms of cybersecurity. I know people say that, you know, there's a lot of hacks in blockchain, but those hacks are because those smart contracts are not audited. So you have certain blockchains such as Ethereum is, and this is one thing, the larger the blockchain becomes, the more decentralized the blockchain becomes, the more secure it becomes. Right? So that's one thing that's very important. So you have these types of networks such as Ethereum, such as Phantom. You're going to see Phantom shortly. The more people that come on these blockchains, the more secure it's going to be, because now you have more people looking at these transactions and say, hey, this doesn't look right. Right? Within higher education, blockchain is going to be an area that's very applicable. If you go to the next slide, and I think that's the demo we're kind of running. All right. So if you click that video, hopefully it starts, and hopefully it's on mute. All right. So this is, no, go to the next other one. This is a, this, the, that's the other, that's the AI one right there. Does it work? Will it go through? All right. Perfect. So this is a quick demo. So could you pause this one real quick? So this is a micro credential, and just to go through this really quick. So if you see that option at the top that says smart contract, a smart contract is essentially a self-executing contract. So from a use case perspective, each university can have your own smart contract, right? And that's essentially the holder of all of these micro credentials. Okay. So within that smart contract, you'll have something referred to as collections. And within those collections, that's each one of those micro credentials. Right. And you could also break it down where the collection can be the class, or the collection can be the micro credential itself. Depends on how you want to do it. Right. Or you could have the contract having each class. Right. And each school, each larger school can have a smart contract for each class. Right. And then each collection can be this own micro credential. And then within those micro credentials, you have NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And you're going to see once we mint this token, that's my certificate. Okay. So you can hit that start, keep going. So that's kind of how the hierarchy goes from a micro credentialing perspective. And I'm so right here. So this, so when I see you choose network, each one of those are different blockchains. So just how you have companies in the real world, you have different blockchains in a decentralized world, right? And each blockchain has its own use case. Like I said, Ethereum is more decentralized. It's more secure. Now it's more expensive because it's more decentralized. But if you need that from a use case perspective, then that's why you would use, that's when you'd use Ethereum. Okay. So now I have all this set up and I'm going to mint my NFT, right? So now I would actually choose my smart contract for my school or for my class, right? So once I have that, there's my certificate. Justin Golston, Dean Rowe has actually approved it down there at the bottom. So I have all this set up and I fill out that certificate. Going through all this. And again, this is just a use case, just one example of how you would actually do a put a certificate on chain. So again, for each school, I mean, it just depends on what the process would be. You could actually streamline and standardize this particular process. So that's one quantity. And then once you scroll down, then you can see that fee currency is in Phantom. So that's where these cryptocurrencies come in. These cryptocurrencies really aren't for just trading and making a lot of money, like people say. These are actually utility tokens, right? So you actually be paying in that particular native currency to mint this NFT on chain. So you can see that particular certificate has been created. And now I'm actually paying the gas fee to mint that certificate on chain right now. So that's going to take a couple of seconds. And now that's pretty much saying that NFT is minted on the blockchain. Okay. So now I'm going through a process to say, okay, if somebody within administration has minted that, then they could actually transfer that to the student. Right. And another thing from a micro credentialing perspective is that we're also integrating this in our supply chain programs. But now, even if you're in a supply chain program, now you have micro credentials in blockchain and in AI because you're interacting with blockchain. You're interacting with AI. So we're creating these interdisciplinary type of micro credentials at National University, regardless of what particular program you're in. Right. And that's the beauty of it. So now once that's minted, so at Phantom Scan, so this is the actual blockchain. So this is a blockchain explorer. So once I've mentioned that, now that's on chain. That can't be changed. That's immutable. That's your validation from an academic perspective. Right. So I'm just kind of going through all this, showing you all the transactions. And yeah, that's kind of the process. From a micro credentialing perspective, and how that would work on the blockchain. So we got 10 minutes. I'll just wrap this up real quick. So last thing I want to talk about is in addition to that, we are also integrating AI within our courses. So this is one class that's also going to be integrated within the fintech program as well as within the supply chain programs. This is a project called Gamak. They're actually in an NVIDIA developer program. So I just had a call with an organization on Monday where they're actually going to be integrating models or agents to develop forecasting tools for our blockchain application. I mean, for our supply chain applications. So we're taking tools. We're taking these agents that everybody's talking about that's being implemented in the real world in organizations, and we're bringing them within the classroom, right? And once again, because these students are interacting with these AI tools, they're also going to get those AI micro credentials. So I know I went over time. That's all I had. Thanks.
Hey, Justin, a quick question in the chat. Are you aware of any LMSs that are currently integrated with blockchains?
Not at this time, but I know that there's some APIs. There's some LMSs that's working on APIs to kind of integrate that and bring that in. It's a common term, but we're very early, so we have to kind of embed those AI tools within those LMS dashboards to bring in the blockchain.
Yeah, and I think I think where I'm seeing it integrate more is the SIS. And so the LMS connecting to the yes. SIS and then the SIS connecting to a distributed ledger blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in a process right now of migrating to Anthology. And I think Anthology has blockchain capabilities, or at least is working on blockchain capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
All right. I do want to leave some time for any Q&A. And just Justin's our obviously blockchain expert, and Michelle is our program developer who comes with these great ideas on how we can improve our programs. I want to talk a little bit about our college and some things we're working on and where we're going. I know this is a bit of an eye chart, and it's just a little bit about the values that inform our college. The basic here is that we know as a College of Business, Engineering, and Technology that we kind of live at that intersection of the great things that are happening in the real world and in the technical sector, business sector, right? That blockchain, AI, fintech. If you look at AI and healthcare, or blockchain and healthcare, we touch law, finance, healthcare, all sectors, really. And so, you know, as a college, we know that we have to be future focused, understanding on what's happening out there and adjust our programs accordingly. And that we have to really focus on programs that are going to serve the entire student. And so that's the whole human ecosystem that we, you know, have the supports the students need when they need. But, you know, with that kind of background on our mindset, what we're thinking about for the college and subsequently the university, I think I could summarize in three or four points. And that is, we're looking at persistence for the students, pathways and portability, programs, and I would be remiss to leave out partnerships. And that's encompassed in those bullets at the bottom that we are actually working on right now, right? So if you look at the curriculum portfolio, we're making sure that we've got the programs like Justin's supply chain program and the pieces we've seen here around fintech, cybersecurity, right, that are essential to our learners. And then how do we create the on and off ramps that the students need and give them credit for what they know and give them that ability to just get the knowledge that they need? So if you think about financial technology, fintech, nanotechnology, AI, ML, all that is changing rapidly. Maybe somebody has a master's degree already. They don't need to come back and get an entire master's degree. They need to come back and get the block of knowledge. And that could be a certificate program, multiple 3-credit-hour courses, or it could be like the one that the example that Justin showed where we disaggregated a 3-credit-hour course into 3 1-credit-hour micro-credentials. You know, a 1-credit-hour micro credential on the applications of fintech. So that's what we're looking at with our programs. On the student engagement side, persistence, right? We have to make sure that we're providing the opportunities within our programs to minimize loss and accelerate momentum, have more engagement with our students, and make sure that they have a sense of community and an online learning environment. So our programs are online. Our model is different than a traditional university in that we have monthly starts for class-based programs. So students typically take one class over 4 weeks at a time in a cohort model. We also have 8-week one-to-one model for our graduate programs where a student is assigned a faculty mentor and they work through curriculum over 8 weeks for a course. So those two models set us up in a distance learning environment, right, to really focus on the learner a different way than a traditional 15-week or 16-week semester. I've got down there competency-based education, and I'm going to address that in a future slide. On the next slide, we're also looking at, for our students, that how we connect them virtually with each other. So we have a virtual student commons that allows our students to connect with their peers outside of the classroom, connect with faculty, have engagement communities that are essential to them, whether it's an affinity group or it's a technical, more discipline-specific group. We are updating all of that in our university environment right now. And all of that student support works towards our university's ways of working, which are off to the trust there. And that's what kind of informs what we do every day. So the competency-based education, the next slide. So all these pieces we've been talking about, providing the micro-credentials, providing the learning when students need it, where they need it, providing it in a way that works for them, giving them credit for prior knowledge, linking that to industry standards, industry certifications, right, is the whole ecosystem that we're looking at. So a lot of that ties in with what I consider competency-based education. So where we decouple seat time from academic proficiency, the Carnegie unit measure that we have right now, but moving to a knowledge-based education system. I mentioned we have monthly and weekly starts in our model already. So in a CBE program that's non-semester based, students can start either, let's say, this weekly model. And then once they demonstrate competency, you let them exit and start again. So they don't have to wait until the end of whatever your term is. So your term may be a month, it may be 8 weeks, or it could be 16 weeks, right? But in competency based, you decouple from that and you let them transcript, maybe blockchain in this case, their knowledge, and then move on to the next course. If we look at the micro-credentialed courses, where we take a 3-credit-hour course and we break it down into smaller subunits, it lets us have those learners easily demonstrate knowledge for subsets lower than a 3-credit-hour course, which if you look at the mapping, and this is a real challenge with credit for prior learning, look at a fantastic industry certification from the American Society of Quality, and you look at your courses, and that mapping's not one-to-one, and you say, oh, I just can't give them credit for that 3-credit-hour course, right? Because this is only meeting 50%, 60% of the content. If your course was smaller in these 1-credit-hour blocks, it gives you that ability to have the students take that demonstrated knowledge and get the academic credit for it. I've done this in a couple of places, launched a competency-based program at a public community college where we broke the courses into 1-credit-hour modules, decoupled from the semester. Students could start any day, learn at their pace. And when they demonstrated mastery, their grade was issued and they could sign up the next day for more courses. I really think you're looking at that as the future of higher education, as long as you're providing the credentials of value. So we're a couple minutes from the closing. Let me stop there. And I'm sure Justin and Michelle have been watching the chat, and we can also take any questions.
And just for the record, I'm not going to kick you out right at the top of the hour. So if people have questions, don't
hey,
panic.
Michelle,
you'll get your answer. And there is a question. If one of you would like to take it, there is a question in the chat about them being the micro credentials sounding like they're primarily asynchronous CBE courses, and how you ensure student to student and student instructor interactions. If anybody wants to tackle that one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So we have lots of innovative strategies for creating engagement in asynchronous learning. One of them is course embedded advising. So we have the instructor meet individually with the students in the middle of the course, and that meeting is asynchronous because it can be done via Zoom or it can be done via email. But the important thing is that it's done and it's a real connection. And that interaction replaces one of the assignments. So that's one thing that we do, but we have lots of different ways that we facilitate student-student interaction, student-faculty interaction, and interaction with the content.
Yeah, and I think you can, the primary thing is, right, making sure that the faculty provide feedback and guidance to students throughout those online meetings through multiple channels, right? Could be engaging in forum discussions with the students, comment on written assignments, the grading, the quizzes, the feedback and guidance related to the academic content of the course, not just about deadlines and reminders, but go beyond that those comments such as good work and great job, but really dive into substantive feedback and guidance on how the student could do better. And I think for us as a institution, right, implementing the periodic audits of our online courses to make sure we're monitoring that substantive interaction, meaningful engagement with the students, in addition to some of the strategies Michelle said.
And it sounded like earlier you mentioned, Dr. Rowe, you mentioned about the student common area. That sounded like that's probably a place that you get some of that student to student. Is somebody assisting with that? I could see how that being a little bit of a challenge when you do have people kind of on ramping and off ramping, whatever direction I'm going there, at you know, different times, like how you kind of maintain those conversations around whatever topic each student is kind of exploring at that point. Is that more with the instructor, or is there somebody kind of interacting with that student area to kind of help that move along?
Yeah, exactly. The latter there. What we've established, we call it the commons, digital commons, right? We have ambassadors to different sections of the commons, and those are typically our faculty, right? So there would be an ambassador for the accounting group within the commons, or the fintech or whatever, right? And that lead faculty member, and then other faculty members or members of the commons are there to help moderate, provide feedback, help create connections, right? Promote the use of the commons in their courses, but we identify those leads as ambassadors.
I love that, because I mean, personally, one of the challenges I always had when I went back to do one of those post-bachelor certificates, because I didn't quite make it to the master's on that program, but was just that siloed, the problem with everything being so siloed, and I had no commons and I had no place to talk to people who were in the course right now or had been through it, or, you know, so I think I'm loving what I'm hearing here. So I've been excited. That's why I love hosting these. I always get to learn cool stuff. So I'm looking, you're having lots of love and thank yous over here. A few people had to jump out. People saying awesome and innovative session. I agree. I absolutely agree. Well worth it. Would love to learn more about your digital commons ambassador, Peter said. So if you want to elaborate any more on that, again, I am going to pause here for just 1 second, just to acknowledge that we kind of blew a little past the top of the hour. That's okay. Like I said, we can stay. But just for those who are having to jump out now, I want to thank you for being here today. For the others who can hang out with us, feel free to, and this will all be, I'll keep the recording on a bit longer, and you won't miss it. You can go back and catch what you missed on the recording. So I'll pass that question back about the, more about the ambassadors.
Yeah. And, Peter, I dropped my email in the chat there. Did we lose him? Oh no, you're still here.
Nope.
So yeah, feel free to shoot me a message and I can actually connect you with some of our ambassadors for some firsthand experience. But within each college or school, we establish communities within the commons, and we ask one of our faculty or even staff members, depending upon the community, to be an ambassador. And with that, they really are responsible for making sure that community is focused and welcoming. We connect our students to that community. They get connected to that ambassador. We still also allow alumni navigators. And so the ambassador helps manage that alumni navigator pool, who is in there, you know, answering questions from students about what's happening, you know, post higher education in their world and giving them the feedback. So it really is a coordinator of that community, but somebody who has that domain specific knowledge and is trained to make it welcoming and inclusive for the students.
Awesome. And it sounds like, Dr. Rowe, it sounds like you're going to have a lot of email heading your way. I see more people that, and which is lovely, because when we were starting out today, I was talking with Dr. Dennis, and she was saying, I love doing these because we find people to collaborate with. And so, see, mission accomplished. I have made new friends. Look at that. My work here is done. I can go away happy, but this has been tremendous.
Webinar. Yes, maybe a future webinar on the commons. Yeah.
I think that. It's on the recording. You have to come back now. It's already like that. That's like that. That's a commitment. I will be happy to take you up on that. I have plenty of open dates coming up in the fall, so we will swing back around about that. But yeah, and I just the whole concept I really love. I was as I was scribbling my notes, which hopefully I can read later. But I just I love the breaking. Okay, full disclosure. My primary focus is gamification and learner engagement. So anything that gets people into a better experience, I'm a big fan of. But I was just, it occurred to me, I hadn't thought about it till today, that breaking those down into those 1 hour modules, because you're focusing more on the learner, which is my, yay, stop being content focused, people. I was like, because you're doing that, and because you're making it interactive, it's reminding me of the power we used to have. The only place you used to see that was in science curricula. You'd have the basic 3 hour or whatever hour thing, and then you'd have the 1 hour lab, right? And we'd send people off to that 1 hour lab. But now it's all the 1 hour lab where they're really getting to, you know, do things and experiment and all of that. So I want to thank you. I want to thank you for what you're doing, because yay. On behalf of learners everywhere, yay! If you could see the back of my laptop right now, it has one of my mottos and one of my stickers on the back, and it's hashtag learners deserve better. So there you go. If anybody wants one, I'll send you one. They're very cool. All right, so I'm going to leave the recording for one more second. Just give everybody a last shot at if anybody has a question. Just lots of thank yous. We'll be in touch. Everything is great. Thank you. And thank you for the private notes I'm getting. I'm getting notes from all over. They're coming all over the place. So with that, I am going to end the recording, but again, I'll stay here for 1 second, do some final little thank yous and things like that. But thank yous to everybody who attended today. And those of you out there in the future watching the replay, we love you too. So we hope to see you again at a future webinar. See you next time.
Thanks, everyone.